from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In 1997, UCSF neurologist Stanley Prusner won the Nobel Prize for his discovery of infectious proteins called prions that cause mad cow disease. That revelation has led to an increased understanding of neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and ALS. We'll talk with Stanley Prusner about the future of brain disease research and his new book, Madness and Memory, The Discovery of Prions, A New Biological Principle of Disease. That's coming up next on Forum, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Bay Area-based Stanley Prusner directs the Institute for Neurodegenerative Diseases, and he's professor of neurology at the University of California, San Francisco. He is also a recipient of many scientific awards and was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1997 for his discovery of prions, which are infectious proteins that cause mad cow disease. Recently, he published Madness and Memory, The Discovery of Prions, A New Biological Principle of Disease, and he joins us in studio for the second Forum Hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let me go back for a moment, and there are many people, prions, what are they? You know, I mean, you still get that, don't you?
Yes, of course.
I mean, essentially we're talking about, like I said, an infectious protein that replicates and can cause disease, but contains no genetic material, and that was a big problem for you. I mean, we'll get to that, but to a great extent, people, there was so much naysaying, I mean, until you really got this in front of the public in a way that finally they had to accept it.
Well, I think the big problem was that we were dealing with something that was mysterious, new, and unprecedented. And that causes problems. It causes a discontinuity, as people say, in science. And these discontinuities always come with big problems of acceptance. And I think they should, because I think most of the grand ideas that come along to explain issues in science that we don't understand, most of these are wrong. And so I think it was a good bet that prions were wrong and that I was wrong. But I didn't think they were wrong because I had done enough experiments before I suggested that we were looking at something very different here become convinced that eventually there would be enough data to show that what I was studying was not a virus.
But what an uphill battle. I mean, just the resistance of the scientific community to prions and surprisingly the animosity, even to the word prion.
Well, I think the word prion was such a good word, and the proof of that is that it's still around, it's stuck, that people got a little upset about this because they could see the power of a single word. I thought a word was very important because we were not dealing with viruses. So to call these infectious particles viruses, slow viruses, atypical viruses, delayed acting viruses, unconventional viruses, this didn't make any sense to me.
It wasn't only wanting those who were giving you a hard time about this and the animosity. It wasn't only resistance to the word and the idea that how could this not be a virus, but how could it not have nucleic acid?
Well, exactly, because if you looked 50 years earlier, what you found was that there had been this big argument about what was a gene. And so many people thought a gene was made of protein, because nucleic acids were too simple. There were only four bases. And so people said, well, a gene has to be a protein because you need complexity. And that was long before we understood that genes are made of DNA, in a few cases RNA, and that genes encode proteins.
Talking to Nobel laureate Stanley Prusner, whose book is Madness and Memory, The Discovery of Prions, A New Biological Principle of Disease. I mean, you have a tremendous amount of laudatory remarks about many of your mentors in this book, which has a lot of memoir qualities to it, and it is indeed in many ways a memoir. Did you feel a little bit like you were maybe settling scores too?
Well, you didn't read the first version of the book. It was
This is tame by
comparison. Oh, this is very tame. And it was very important to tame it. So I had a lot of editorial help from a fabulously talented woman named Sarah Lippincott in Los Angeles.
And still there, you know, I found as someone who's been in the broadcast journalism world for many years, I found myself surprised and a bit shocked because we do a lot of science on this program. There's Science Friday that NPR produces. Not only the animosity and the resistance, but also, you know, for example, let's give David Perlman his props. I mean, San Francisco Chronicle science writer who right away was very open to these ideas. And, you know, he's had a distinguished career. But you have people like one of the editors of Science Magazine and, well, Omni Magazine, I mean, who were really almost gunning for you. And I mean, I found it just appalling in some ways. Called a carpet salesman and Omni Magazine. I mean, this is crazy stuff. And I didn't really know even what to make of it. I thought I didn't blame you for not wanting to talk to the press after that.
Well, I think the problem is that when you get a new idea, a very new idea, the press is ill-equipped to handle it. First of all, they don't have the background to judge it. Second, they don't have the time to analyze it on their own. And third, many times science is treated like politics in that you go around and you poll people who are experts and you get their thoughts. And if all the experts are telling you this has to be wrong, well, then you believe it's wrong. And if the experts are telling you that a virus must cause these diseases, and you've heard the word virus since you were a young child, but now some one person or two people are telling you that it's a prion and you've never heard of prions, well, you can understand how the press would react.
So account for your tenacity in all this. I mean, you were dogged in spite of all that adversity and all that rejection of your ideas. What do you make of just your own tenacity?
Well, I think when I look back on it, the problem was that I would look around for an equally exciting problem to study, and I couldn't find one. So I was so enamored with this that I didn't know where to go, so I kept working.
You like solving puzzles. In fact, early on in the book, you talk about going to high school in Cincinnati, Walnut Hills, and your homeroom teacher said, you don't deserve to be in AP chemistry. In effect, said he didn't think you could handle it. And I wondered about how much that was maybe a motivator. You say, no, I just really like chemistry because I didn't have to memorize, but it must have been somewhat of a motivator.
I don't think so.
No?
But, you know, I've thought about that a number of times, but I hope it wasn't. But maybe I'm wrong.
Well, there's so many anecdotes that struck me in the book. When you went to the NIH, for example, your first day at the NIH, guy says, I forgot you were coming. I mean, these kinds of things can be enormous stumble blocks for somebody on a scientific pathway or trajectory.
Well, yeah, that was not a good way to start. You know, I think it's really important as a scientist to be objective. And you need to cut through a lot of the emotion. And you have to cut through the emotion of your colleagues. You have to cut through the emotion of yourself. Because in science, you get an idea, and when the idea doesn't work out, very often you keep working on it. You don't put it aside. I mean, the best scientists are the ones who recognize that certain areas, well, this was all wrong. We can't go down that road. It's wrong. And the idea that if you can think of it, it must be right is really a detriment in science.
Well, in this discovery of yours, really discovery of this infectious pathogen, prions, now well known throughout the world as prions, you also acknowledge that luck played a big role.
A huge role. I mean, I could have started out and I could have been studying an atypical virus. That's for sure. It could have been a little different, and that would have explained the small amount of data that had been accumulated. Another possibility is that that it could have been a prion, but it could have been so rare that I would not have been able to find it with the tools that I had available. So both of those would have led down different paths. Now, the first one I don't think would have been so terrible. It would have been an interesting, different kind of virus. That wasn't the way it is.
There was also a claim by Carlton Gajicek that he had discovered the he called it an unconventional virus. This is a guy who was known as the guru of Kuru, and I happen to know his brother, who was a colleague of mine for many years, but also known as Dr. America, wound up in prison, but that's a whole other story. But the fact of the matter is, again, you got a lot of resistance and animus and difficulties from him.
Well, he was a man who was extremely bright, who could talk for hours and hours and hours. He could begin a lecture, and 5 hours later you had half of the audience still there listening to him. He was a spellbinding speaker. He wasn't a good scientist. He was a great speaker. He was a great organizer. But he liked to dream, and he would come up with one idea after another, and I would say, Carlton, you know, you just told me 7 seconds ago that it was a calcium ion that caused these diseases, and now you're telling me that it's a protein, and then you tell me it's a virus, and I would say, you know, that's not science. That's just throwing a bunch of words out there. And he would say to me, well, if I think of it, it's important.
If it pops in my head.
Exactly.
What makes a good scientist, in your judgment?
I think a good scientist, and good scientists come in all kinds of shapes and sizes and thoughts. I think that good scientists have one characteristic, I think, in common, and that is that they focus on a problem and they go deeper and deeper and deeper. And they don't go sideways. They stay focused on what they're trying to do. And because science is hard and you're looking at a lot of unknowns, you don't know where these unknowns are going to take you. It's really a fog. And if you're really in an area where there's very little information and you're trying to create something new out of all of this, you have to constantly keep asking the questions, keeping all these questions in front of you. It's not one question. It's a series of questions. But you can't follow one and then stop and then go follow another one. You've got to have the whole set of unknowns in front of you, constantly pushing back these areas of ignorance.
To stay in the fog.
Yes.
We're talking to Nobel laureate Stanley Prusner, MD, who is the author of Madness and Memory, The Discovery of Prions, a New Biological Principle of Disease, which was published by Yale University Press. Let's talk about prions in terms of, well, the future, because it's normally associated with mad cow disease, with Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, with diseases that most people aren't all that familiar with. But the fact of the matter is that you see application to many of the things that have been identified as being hopeful tied to stem cells. And I'm talking about Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig disease. Trace for us how that connection has been made in your mind.
So I think that over the past 3 decades, we've seen a steady accumulation of information. And it really begins with some what I would call not-so-good experiments that Carlton Gajicek did. We were talking about him before, where he got excited when he did this groundbreaking work with Kuru, a disease of New Guinea natives, and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which you mentioned, which we call CJD for short. And these diseases he was able to transmit into apes and monkeys. So at that point in the late 1960s, he thought, gee, I wonder if all these other degenerative diseases of the brain, such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS, if they would be transmissible. So he did these kinds of experiments. And he got 2 positives, 2 cases of what he thought were familial Alzheimer's disease. So these are inherited forms of Alzheimer's disease from the mother or the father to the offspring. When he tried to repeat this work over a 10-year period, it was not repeatable. So the conclusion was the samples were mixed up with some CJD samples. Things languished for a while. In the mid-1980s, we found that a really surprising, and I devote a whole chapter to that in the book, a really surprising discovery that the purified, now we call them prions, scrapie agent, as it was called, because scrapie is a disease like CJD and Kuru, that the scrapie agent would aggregate into these long fibrils called amyloid. And people for years, for as long as the disease, almost
these are
as
amyloid
long,
proteins, yeah.
So the amyloid proteins, but amyloid fibers. And these fibers had been known for a long time, for many, many years, in Alzheimer's disease. And they were thought to be present in Parkinson's disease because of these stains that pathologists use, these dyes that they stain tissue with, detect amyloid. So that was an exciting finding that we made here in San Francisco with the help of a man named George Glenner, who was very prominent in the Alzheimer's field and discovered the small piece of a protein called a peptide that makes up the amyloid fiber in Alzheimer's. But that discovery that I made made us think that maybe Alzheimer's and Parkinson's were going to be prion diseases. But it took a long time after that. And, you know, you can look back and you can say, well, gee, maybe you should have gone away from scrapie and gone to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And my answer is always, well, you know, I couldn't wrestle 500-pound gorillas. I needed to just stay focused on one problem. But other people have gotten into this area. And a lot of the work has followed the leads that we made and the discoveries we made and with the what we call PRP, prion diseases. And now it's quite clear that Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are similar diseases.
And that means what in terms of actually doing something about, what, 5.3 million cases of Alzheimer's, 500,000 new ones each year?
Yes, I think it's really important because it tells us what the first step is in these diseases, that a normal protein, not the one found in CJD, but a normal protein called A-beta, the one Glenner discovered now almost 30 years ago, and another protein in Parkinson's disease, synuclein, so these are kind of odd names, that these proteins turn into prions. And this is the first step in the chain of events that leads to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases.
How irrefutable is that? We're still in a hypothetical stage, aren't we?
Well, I don't think so, because there's been a lot of data accumulated over the last decade and a half to argue for this. And by a lot of different laboratories. Some of it's better than other pieces, and we've done some of it ourselves. I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't starting to believe things because I wanted prions to be bigger than life. But in fact, that's the way it seems to be turning out, that prions, different proteins, become prions. We know, for instance, it's not all about disease. So this is becoming a very widespread phenomenon. So it's not surprising that a half a dozen neurodegenerative diseases, or maybe even all of them, are caused by prions. When you have prions in yeast, you have prions in other fungi, you have normal prions in mammals, involved in memory, involved in what's called innate immunity. So this is not an isolated phenomenon.
Are the turf battles going on now with respect to prion research?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You want to comment on that?
Well, it's interesting because new ideas take time. And so while Alzheimer's disease is not exactly like Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease or Kuru, and Alzheimer's disease is not – that we have no evidence that it's spread by ritualistic cannibalism the way Kuru was spread, the data are accumulating that we have an internal infection in the brain. Starts in an area near your ears but inside in your brain with Alzheimer's disease and spreads. And this spread is infection from one of prions from one neuron to the next. Same thing happens in Parkinson's disease, but it can begin even in the gut and move to the brain.
So without revealing any trade secrets, your Institute for Neurodegenerative Diseases is doing what kind of research?
So we're focused primarily now on therapeutics. And so we're trying to develop drugs. And we just have entered into a collaboration with a Japanese drug company called Daiichi Sankyo that began about 3 weeks ago. So we're very excited about this because they bring a lot of resources that we don't have, and we bring a lot of knowledge and techniques that they don't have. And I think it's going to be a very, very rich collaboration.
How did that partnership take place?
Well, it began really with my saying to one of my former colleagues, David Ramsey, who was here for many years at UCSF and about 20 years ago left to become president of the University of Maryland at Baltimore. He comes back to San Francisco to retire with his wife, Anne. And I say to him, David, you can't retire. You've got to come and work with me as I build this institute. And he says, okay, I'll come part-time. So he has a long, long history of working out collaborations with Japanese Big Pharma and other companies involved in biology and medicine. And so it's really through him that this all began. It's been about almost a year now since we had the first discussions.
Our guest, if you've just joined us, is UCSF neurologist Stanley Prusner, who is a Nobel laureate and director of the Institute for Neurodegenerative Diseases, professor of neurology at University of California, San Francisco. Boy, before you got tenure there, you were a lightning rod even then.
Yes. I probably was a lightning rod as a child, but
you had a pretty normal kind of nice childhood for me. Let me invite those of you listening who may have questions or comments to join this discussion. Indeed, we'd like to hear from you, and we welcome your participating in the discussion here. Our toll-free number is available to you, and you can join us now. That number, 866-733-6786. If you have questions or comments for Stanley Prusner, feel free to join us if you'd just like to join the conversation. Likewise, again, the number to join us at is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Number of ways that you can communicate any questions or comments you might have. Before I go to the break, and we've got seconds left here, can you just tell that story about your Swedish mentor, Ale, and that brass pocket knife? I think it's a great story.
Oh, it's a wonderful story. I'm in Buenos Aires at a meeting of the International Congress of Neurology, and I'm walking around in Buenos Aires, and I stumbled into a store that had a lot of military antiques, medals, things like that. And I saw this wonderful pocket knife with an inscription on it. It was from a mining company, and it had all kinds of tools. And for a very small amount of money, I bought it. And then I flew from there to this was a few weeks before the Nobel Prize was announced, to Stockholm to a symposium, which I'm sure they were taking a last kind of look to make sure that they weren't making a mistake, a big mistake. And before all this started, my former mentor came to visit. He was living north in a farm area, but he came back to Stockholm, and we were sitting in the hotel room, and I knew that he liked things like this, and I showed it to him, and he thought I was giving him a gift. And it was one of the most embarrassing moments in my life.
It still embarrasses you to this day.
It does.
Talking to Stanley Prusner, Nobel laureate and also Eagle Scout, which is almost as impressive to me. When we return, we'll take your calls and emails. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In 1997, University of California, San Francisco neurologist Stanley Prusner won the Nobel Prize for his discovery of infectious proteins called prions that cause mad cow disease, and that revelation has led to an increased understanding of neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and ALS, or Lou Gehrig disease. He's joined us this hour to talk about his work, The Future of Brain Disease Research, his new book, Madness and Memory, The Discovery of Prions, a New Biological Principle of Disease, and we'll go right to your calls. We'll go first to Gary. Gary, join us.
Yes, my name is Gary, and I'm in San Francisco, and I was always told that Parkinson's wasn't inherited, but my paternal grandmother had Parkinson's-like symptoms. My mother, who just passed away at 90, had a mild case of Parkinson's. My father's twin brother had Parkinson's. And my father, he started to show Parkinson's-like symptoms when he passed away at the age of 58. I've always been in very good health, very good shape, and in 2008 I started having quivers in my left hand, and the last year and a half my symptoms are not very good, but the only thing that keeps me going is the carbidopa levodopa, which is a drug that's 40 to 50 years old. And my question is, why is there something out there that's better than this drug, which is still the gold standard of Parkinson's?
Well, before Dr. Prusiner answers your question about the drug, I'd like to find out, Stanley Prusiner, your thoughts about heredity in Parkinson's. Our Friday host, Dave Iverson, did a Frontline special on Parkinson's. He's Norwegian descent. His father had Parkinson's. His brother has Parkinson's. There does seem to be a genetic line in many cases.
So I think, somewhere between 10 and 20% of Parkinson's cases are familial. They're inherited, just as you're saying, Gary. But in all cases of Parkinson's disease, we see this protein called synuclein. And synuclein is present in the sporadic cases and most of the cases of inherited Parkinson's disease. And it accumulates, and synuclein becomes a prion. Now, there are a few cases of in what are called genetic forms or inherited forms of Parkinson's disease that don't involve synuclein, but I think that gets very complicated. So I think the real focus is on synuclein. And you're absolutely right. L-DOPA, levodopa, does not cure the disease. It treats the disease symptomatically. It ameliorates the symptoms, but the underlying process continues on. And so it's the reason why someone like the Pope, Pope John II, who got the best of possible all possible care on the planet, you can be sure, continued to get worse. And you're absolutely right. There is a screaming need for new therapies that focus on the underlying cause, which I believe is the conversion of the normal protein synuclein into a prion.
What about new drugs, since he mentioned the drug he was taking?
So that drug is the one that does not stop this process. What it does is it deals with the deficit created by the synuclein prions, and that deficit is a deficit in dopamine. Mm-hmm. And DOPA, L-DOPA, is converted directly into dopamine. So what you're doing is you're helping the brain deal with the problem symptomatically, but you're not stopping the underlying process with L-DOPA. So, Gary, you're exactly right, and my heart goes out to you, and that I'm very hopeful that in the not-too-distant future we'll have some real drugs that stop the synuclein prions, which people will be able to take.
And, Gary, good luck to you, and thank you for calling us. We'll go right to another caller, and that's Mike. You're on, Mike.
Hi, good morning. I got a question. Multiple sclerosis has not been mentioned at all. I'm wondering if it's related to this cause. And secondly, there appears to be two kinds of multiple sclerosis, relapsing remitting and progressive. And I guess my feeling is that the progressive, there may be two different causes for both of these. That's my question.
Well, let me begin with a disclaimer that I'm not an expert on multiple sclerosis, even though one of my closest friends, Steve Hauser, the chair of neurology at UCSF, is an expert, and we talk about it a lot. But I think we don't have a clear understanding of the causes of multiple sclerosis. This is a problem. So you're right. These different forms may have slightly different causes. I mean, what we do know is that there's some very good therapies now for multiple sclerosis. Even though we don't have such a clear understanding of the details of some of the causal events, the therapies which interfere with the immune system seem to work quite well in many, many instances. So I don't have a perfect answer to what you're asking. I don't think that prions are involved in multiple sclerosis, but you never can tell, but I don't think so. I don't think there's any evidence to argue for that.
Mike, we thank you for the call. I'm going to go to our website, number of questions, and then we'll go to more of your calls. Debbie asks, what's the difference between the old variant CJD, that is Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, and the new variant CJD, mad cow? Are the prions different? My mother-in-law died of the old variant per the autopsy. Just wondering how this determination was made. She vacationed in England during the infectious period of mad cow.
So The new variant CJD is caused by prions coming from the cows who had BSE or mad cow disease. And the pathology in human beings is very distinctive. They have what are called florid amyloid plaques. We were talking about amyloid before as this generic term in which proteins accumulate in a certain fibrillar pattern. And so you do not see these florid amyloid plaques in what's being referred to as old variant. Well, it's not old variant. It's just classical CJD or CJD that's found throughout the world.
Another listener asks, what's the status of research into the consumption of traces of metals as a cause of brain diseases like Alzheimer's? For instance, nuts contain copper, and water filtration devices that use KDF-55 filters add copper to their output. Is copper intake linked to any brain disease?
Well, there are many studies on looking at metals as toxins in brain diseases. And each time, for instance, in Alzheimer's disease, when aluminum has been implicated, there's a lot of uproar, a lot of excitement that we may have something where we can simply chelate the aluminum and prevent the disease.
Doesn't seem to go anywhere, though.
Well, that's because then there's a study that follows it and shows that there's no link to the disease. So this has been a lot of detective work that hasn't led anywhere, a lot of false leads.
We'll go to some more of your calls. We'll go to Sharon next. Sharon, welcome. You're on the air. Good morning.
Did you say Sharon?
I said Sharon.
Oh, good. Oh, thank you so much. I was just curious. You were talking about ALS and Alzheimer's, especially the young genetic onset. I was wondering if you're including Huntington's in that, and is it a prion, and are you working towards therapy for that?
Well, I think that Huntington's is a prion disease. So this is a good segue into a little more talk, a little more discourse, I guess, a little more lecture about the inherited forms of these neurodegenerative diseases. And you need to ask why it is that people get neurodegenerative diseases when they're older. They're not young. And so if you, for instance, in Huntington's disease, you inherit a mutation that causes the disease to appear when you're 50 or 60 years old, why is it that that mutation in Huntington's disease, which is known to cause the disease, didn't result in the manifestation of the disease when you were 5 years old or 6 years old or 10 years old? Well, one of the theories is that it takes a long time for the protein to accumulate, the mutant protein in Huntington's disease. And my argument is that in these inherited neurodegenerative diseases, there's a second event. That's, I think, true of most late-onset diseases. There has to be something that triggers. And for a long time, people have tried to pin these events down. And now I think we're beginning to think that these events, in fact, are the conversion of the mutant form of the Huntington protein into a prion, and that the prion formation is the second event. It happens, and then it's cleared. It happens, it's cleared. But then at some point, because they have the mutation, it's not cleared.
Let me thank the caller. I just had an MRI recently, and my doctor called me and said, well, you're going to see on your MRI report that your brain is atrophying, but don't be alarmed. Literally, this is what she said to me. She said, this is just, you know, part of aging. And I'm wondering, you know, if the brain is atrophying as you're aging, which clearly is the case, if that could also, because you were talking before about as you get older, just accumulating more.
Well, the problem is that aging is not a good thing. And the second point is that we, for a long, long time, had no understanding of Alzheimer's versus senility. So we used to accept the fact that as people aged, because Alzheimer's disease is so frequent, that in fact this was just simple normal aging and people became senile.
Dementia.
Exactly. So if you look at the statistics from the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, you notice that about 1978 they start recording Alzheimer's disease and it goes up and up and up and it gets to about 80,000 people a year dying from Alzheimer's disease in 2010. Well, this doesn't make any sense. And you look at cancer, it's about 550,000. You look at heart disease, about 600,000. And you say to yourself, how is it that this could be? because there are 500,000 new cases of Alzheimer's disease every year. The disease lasts about 10 years, and there are about 5 million people with the disease. So another 500,000 ought to be dying each year. And so I brought together a group of epidemiologists, and I wrote a small article in the Wall Street Journal, an op-ed piece with George Vredenburg a few weeks ago about this, because we finally got these epidemiologists to do the right kinds of studies and look and see. And it turns out that three different groups came up with a number of 500,000 people dying each year with Alzheimer's disease. So it's right there at the top with cancer, heart disease. But this is a disease, because every time you meet a person who's 90 and they think perfectly, you can have a coherent conversation. They remember events well. They can do their own finances. Those people are normal. They're the other half. But the disease is so frequent when you get beyond 80 that people thought that this was not a disease.
Chris, what's fascinating about that is just the diagnostics involved. I mean, you know, you think about autism the same way. The numbers seem to just go up disproportionately, but I think they finally got a hold of what the spectrum is and how to define diagnostically what autism is.
Well, I think that's exactly right. But the confusion was that this is heresy, what I will say now, is that many, many doctors who are not neurologists believe the body ends at the neck. And so if you go in, if you look at a nursing home, for instance, where people come in, they have dementia as a clinical diagnosis, probably Alzheimer's disease, since most cases are Alzheimer's, and now these people die. And you look at the death certificate. Nowhere on the death certificate is listed dementia or Alzheimer's disease or 20 other causes of dementia. It's only heart disease or cancer or urinary tract infection or pneumonia. So this has skewed our understanding of what's going on.
And we bring more of our callers on. We go next to you, David, in Santa Rosa. Join us.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to ask Dr. Posner, in his experience and having mentioned already that the mainstream frequently rejects new ideas and we have a peer-reviewed funding system that can make it hard to expand the research, whether he has any out-of-the-box thoughts on what systems might be developed to harness other funding than that that's being controlled by the, quote, experts in a field. And, you know, the fact that we have developing entrepreneurs with who've been successful with ideas and have money, whether he has any thoughts on mechanisms or forums that might be useful to develop as new funding sources.
Well, I think, you know, the big problem is that we don't know how to identify research that will lead somewhere important early on. This is just our ignorance. So we don't have a mechanism to do that. We need to back bright, young, well-trained people. We need to back people who have made important discoveries and are likely to make more in the future. And just how we do this is really a combination of public funding and private funding. And I think there's no substitute for backing basic research. This is really, really important. This is research where we don't have, for instance, a therapy in mind, where we're just trying to uncover a phenomenon and whether it's related to a disease directly or maybe we won't know about any relationship for many years. We need to support this. And we need to not make the NIH, the NSF, NASA, we need to not make these organizations political footballs. And so when the funding goes up and down, it destroys the interest in science. It wipes out many, many careers. And this is really bad for our country. It's bad for the world.
Well, a good example that comes to mind is your own trajectory. I mean, there was a period when you were seeking funding, and because you weren't saying this is virus related or nucleic acid related, it kind of blackballed you, in effect, from getting funding. I mean, There's a program at UC that I happen to know about that gets some funding from private sources. It's called Blue Skies. And, you know, these are scientists who have some pretty wild and far out ideas, and the results have been pretty impressive because these people are fearless in terms of willingness to fund these programs.
Yes, I think these kinds of programs are models for what we should be doing. But one of the things that's really important to understand is that science is extremely expensive. And we lose track of that. So one of the things that keeps happening as we end up with these valleys and peaks of funding is that we end up with small grants. And not all science can be solved with small amounts of money. So we're really in a bind right now. And exactly how to get out of this, I don't have a recipe.
Well, the money's drying up to a great extent, too, isn't it?
Yes.
Let me go to some more questions for you from listeners. Here's Jackie who asks, how does the immune system cope with prions, and how does the prion theory of Alzheimer's relate to the fact that Alzheimer's disease has been correlated with diet and lifestyle factors such as overweight, high cholesterol, etc.?
Well, first of all, the immune system doesn't have a role in Alzheimer's disease. There are many people who would argue with that, but there's no evidence for the immune system to play a role.
There's some people who believe the immune system has a role in everything.
Right, I understand. And there are these neuroinflammatory responses, as we would call them, in the glial cells that surround the neurons in the brain. But in terms of the immune system and lymphocytes and antibodies, there is no role that we know about. So to the second part of that, there's not a stitch of evidence that diet does anything to Alzheimer's disease. Now, there is some confusion that comes when you talk about cholesterol and atherosclerosis, because when you look at people who are over 60, they all have some small amount of atherosclerosis. And if you have a bad diet, you end up with more of that. And diminished blood flow to your brain does not help your brain. It worsens the changes in Alzheimer's disease. But this is not Alzheimer's disease.
Another listener, Tony, who asked, besides the degenerative diseases, does the prion knowledge have applications in behavior areas like addiction and alcoholism or depression?
So we don't know this, but this is an area that I'm very, very interested in. One of the very hot topics in the prion area involves football players, soccer players, hockey players, and soldiers who get these what are called frontotemporal dementias that my close colleague Bruce Miller works on, and another close colleague Bill Seeley, both at UCSF. And these frontotemporal dementias are extraordinary because, as you know, many of these football players who develop a frontotemporal dementia go on and commit suicide. Well, the way this presents, the frontal lobes are, I mean, just behind your forehead, are the most advanced part of your brain. That part of the brain developed last in the evolution of people. That's the part of the brain that encodes executive function, which allows you to think tomorrow, the next day, a year from now, 2 years from now. It allows you to hold a job, to get up in the morning and go there. When that area stops working, you become disinhibited. Your brain stops inhibiting all of these very primitive reflexes, primitive thoughts. And so now you move into areas like drug addiction, alcoholism. But people who, not football players, but 50-year-olds who've been normal, who develop a frontotemporal dementia, they're seen by psychiatrists for 2 or 3 years because of behavior problems that then evolve into more clear neurologic disease, and then they move to see a neurologist.
Here's another listener who writes, while I understand the appeal of discussing the sociology of science in the context of prions, it would be great if you could also discuss some of the ideas involved in arguing for prions as the basis of neurodegenerative disease.
I actually thought we've been discussing this.
Yeah, but, so did I.
But I'm happy. I'm happy to review it.
Well, they need a little more clarity, perhaps.
So there are many clues to this from looking at humans. And then there are many clues to this at looking at animal experimental studies with animals and with cultured cells. And when you can show that these various degenerative diseases are transmissible from cell to cell in a culture, and you can show that these diseases are transmitted when you inoculate the animals even with synthetic peptides, so synthetic proteins made either in bacteria or made by just chemically linking the amino acids together, you start to believe that these are prion diseases.
I think that's exactly what that listener was looking for. Well done. We're going to go to more of your calls here. Let's go next to George. George, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Hi.
Very interesting discussion. It sounds like there were many skeptics at the time of the original discovery, but in retrospect, it's not inconceivable that proteins could self-replicate simply because of the intimate correspondence between genetic material and proteins. But I guess I was curious about why do some proteins form self-replicating prions and some don't?
All right, so let me maybe clarify something that I can see that I should have said earlier. So one of the big riddles in all of this was, okay, here are these prions replicating. How do they replicate? Does this violate what has been referred to as the central dogma of biology, where genes are encoding proteins, the genes are made of DNA, and the information is transferred to RNA, or what's called messenger RNA, and then proteins are made? Well, that's exactly what happens with prions. So the normal form of the protein is made, and then the protein adopts an alternative shape. And when that shape is adopted, it can adopt a lot of different shapes, but one or two or ten of these are prions because that shape becomes self-replicating, self-propagating. So this is a protein that has an altered shape. It grabs another normal form of the same protein and turns it into another alternate shape, a prion. So that's how prions multiply. And I think that's a very important thing to understand. So it's not as though these proteins just sort of come out of thin air. Now, why do some proteins become prions? There's no single theme. In yeast, what was discovered is that the prion region of a yeast protein, and now there are at least a dozen different yeast proteins that are known to be prions, contain a lot of two amino acids, two specific amino acids out of 20. But in the prions that are found in mammals, we don't understand why some become prions and most do not.
More of the fog that has to be
exactly.
Yeah, let me thank the caller, and let me remind you, we're talking to Dr. Stanley Prusiner, author of Madness and Memory, The Discovery of Prions, A New Biological Principle of Disease. He's a Nobel laureate, and he's also going to be one of the featured speakers. This KQED is a media sponsor of this event at the New York Times Health for Tomorrow conference at UC San Francisco, May 28th and 29th, and you can get details by going to the website nyhealthfortomorrow.com, nyhealthfortomorrow.com. Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll go next to a caller in Palo Alto. Tom, you're on.
Yes, thank you. I'm curious. I'm 14 years into my diagnosis with Parkinson's, so I'm interested in DBS as an opportunity to get alleviation of my symptoms. I heard recently that the DBS electrodes actually stimulate the regeneration of dopamine-producing cells in the substantia nigra. I wonder if that's accurate, and I was curious about arthroscopic DBS, you might call it, and whether that's ready for prime time.
Well, I think that deep brain stimulation has a very important role in managing Parkinson's disease, but usually late in the disease. I don't know about deep brain stimulation stimulating the multiplication of dopamine containing neurons. I would be skeptical of that, but, you know, I can be wrong, so I'm not sure.
And by the way, I think I gave out the wrong website on that event that I referenced before. It should be nythealthfortomorrow.com. Irene tells me I said NY, so let me thank the caller. Have artificial protons, Joseph asked, been constructed in the lab?
So I guess the question is, have artificial prions been constructed?
That's the question.
The okay.
Yeah.
And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
We've done this and others have done it in multiple ways. We've used bacteria to produce the protein and then purified the protein and then refolded it so it has a different shape. It has a prion shape and shown that it works when we inoculate animals with it. And other people have done this with cells in culture. And then we've also taken the Alzheimer's prion, the small piece, which is about 40 amino acids long. So proteins are typically 100 or 500 amino acids in length. But now we're taking a small piece called a peptide, and we've now refolded that. This is the work of some of my colleagues at UCSF and shown that becomes a prion.
Well, exciting vistas up ahead, especially this new partnership with the Japanese company. And good luck to you on that score. And so good to have you on Forum. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Stanley Prusner, again, will be one of the featured speakers, New York Times Health for Tomorrow conference. That's May 28th and 29th. And details, I just want to give this website again, nythealthfortomorrow.com. His book, again, is Madness and Memory, The Discovery of Prions, a New Biological Principle of Disease. It's published by Yale University Press. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And we remind you, you can continue this discussion on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And always let us know what you think you'd like to hear on Forum or about what you've heard on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Also want to remind you that we are produced daily by some pretty extraordinary people. Dan Zoll is our senior editor, and our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg, with Amanda Stupai as our engagement producer. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, we appreciate your being with us today. Stay tuned. Tomorrow we'll be with Barbara Ehrenreich in this hour. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.